Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Edward Ball, author of Life of a Klansman, A Family History and White Supremacy. Edward Ball is one of the most interesting writers of nonfiction working today. His first book, Slaves in the Family, centered on his father's family in South Carolina, and it won the National Book Award in 1998. When that book was published, he said, "Maybe someday I'll write about my mother's family, the Louisiana branch of the family." He wrote more books, The Sweet Hell Inside, Peninsula of Lies, The Genetic Strand, and The Inventor and the Tycoon, and then turned his attention to that long-promised work. The result is the stunning new book, Life of a Klansman, A Family History and White Supremacy, and it is very much a work for this moment. Edward Ball, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You've said that you were driven to write this book by the deaths of Trayvon Martin and so many others, and that those events gave you a renewed sense of urgency that got you back to this story. What was that moment like when you really turned your attention to this?
I started thinking about this more than 10 years ago, after I inherited the genealogy notes of an aunt who had died. But I didn't start writing it until the eruption of violence of the past 6 or 8 years began with the killing of Trayvon Martin, and the Charleston, South Carolina massacre at Emanuel AME. And it seemed that we were in a moment when white supremacy was showing its violent face. And I thought this was the right time to tell a story that was a family story about whiteness and its presence in all of us today.
And also, one of the things that struck me is by the prevalence of this type of story. By your calculations, you know, the demographics would lead us to believe that 80 million Americans have an ancestor in the Klan in their family.
It's probably more than that. It's not an aberration to have a Klansman in your family. And I'll tell you how that statement is true. In the mid-1920s, the Klan could claim about 4 million members. And if you take that number of people and count forward 100 years to estimate the number of their descendants, their grandchildren and great-grandchildren, a simple projection in demography shows that there are about 135 million living white Americans, which is nearly one half of the white population of the United States, who can claim a family link to the Ku Klux Klan. So it's not a rare thing at all. In fact, half of the white population could, if they wanted to, write a Klan family memoir, like Life of a Klansman.
Now, this is a micro-history, a story of one man whose life illuminates an entire era. And that man is your great-great-grandfather, Polycarp Constant Lecorne. Tell us about him, how you first heard about him, and how you continued to learn about him.
I first heard about Constant Lecorne, when I was a child, visiting aunts and grandparents in New Orleans. He was our Klansman. He was spoken of infrequently. It wasn't a family obsession, but it was commonly known that we had a member of the Ku Klux in our family tree. He had helped to reestablish white supremacy when it was threatened in New Orleans by the occupation of the Union forces in Louisiana. And so he was something of a family notorious hero, but he wasn't well documented because he was a simple man. He was a ship carpenter. He lived in Bouligny off of Napoleon Avenue near Chapultepec, where the Lacorne family lived for about 100 years. And so it was many years later, as an adult, and as a writer, in fact, that I came back to try to uncover this man's story. And because he was an ordinary fellow, he'd have left no papers, no diaries and letters and the things that rich people sometimes leave behind. So it was a matter of writing, what you say, a micro history, which is a history of a simple person, an ordinary person, based upon public records principally.
Now, part of this book is a history of the Klan itself, particularly as it existed in New Orleans. You talk about the rise of organizations like the Knights of the White Camellia, the White League, and finally the Ku Klux Klan. You tell us also the origin of the name for Ku Klux Klan, which I never knew.
It's said that Ku Klux is derived from the Greek word kuklos, which means circle. And the Ku Klux Klan originates in Tennessee in 1866 or 67, where a small group of Confederate veterans, educated men, lawyers, newspaper men, come together, and in their drinking sessions, they decide they're going to create a circle, which is patterned after the Greek societies or the fraternities that they have known from their time in higher education. And this is the origin of this thing. And to make it more mysterious, they spelled it with K's instead of with C's. And this phenomenon spills out of Tennessee into the upper reaches of Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Georgia in the 1860s. And it expresses itself in southern Louisiana with a set of white supremacist organizations that have different names. I seem to mention them, the White League, La Ligue Blanche, and others, the White Line in Mississippi. And so it's, you know, we think about New Orleans as it's a glorious city. It's the root source of American music. It's the home to the best cookery. It teaches the country about carnival and about festival. It is a glorious place, but it is also a place where some of the factories of white supremacy were housed, where the thing itself was designed and perfected. And it has this less well-known reputation as a place where whiteness was developed into a refined substance that could be enforced by violence.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Edward Ball, who's the author of Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. You're reconstructing a lot of important events from New Orleans history in this book, including the Mechanics Institute riots, the Battle of Canal Street, even the infamous 1873 Missing Links Comus Parade.
That's right. It's a city that the histories of the city having to do with carnival are folded into the histories of these white supremacist organizations. You mentioned the 1873 parade, the Comus Parade of 73, had the theme of the missing link, Darwin's theory of evolution had trickled into American education in the, you know, the 1860s, and Comus decided to parody it in a parade theme that brought out monkeys who were clearly designed as spoofs of black citizens. And there was a direct association between the carnival imagery and the kind of maintenance of a white and black superiority and inferiority structure.
This is also a story of class, as the Licorne family fortunes fall. I mean, Polycarp Constant Licorne was an indifferent student. He was not good with money. And he lived in the city in a time of the Grand Blancs and the Petite Blancs. So talk a little bit about that.
The Licornes were not quite of the Grand Blanc class, the big whites of the slaveholding period. They were slaveholders. They had a tenuous foothold in the plantation elite. But by the 1850s, they began to slide into the class of manual laborers. And by the time of my great-great-grandfather, Constant, they were petit blanc. They were working men and women. They were tinsmiths. They were carpenters. They were school teachers. The women were school teachers. So it's persuasive to me that as this family, our family, slid on the class totem pole, their resentment towards African Americans grew proportionally. And it appears that Constant lost a lot of money investing in the Confederate War, in the War of the Rebellion, as the Yankees called it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was struggling to make a living. And this, as it is today, some of the fuel of white aggression today derives directly from the sort of economic pauperization, if you like, the loss of status that that white people feel. And this is what the Licorne story is about. It's tinder for a fire of violence that permeated this man's life.
Another thing is that so many institutions figure into this story. The police force, the fire department to which Licorne belonged, newspapers of the time. And it seems like in chronicling all these institutions, you give us a sense of how systemic racism grew over time.
Yes, it's the story of the birth and spread of white supremacy as told through the life of one family. And it's an ideology that was created, this is my theory of it, in the years after the Civil War, and cultivated and strengthened by, as you say, a number of institutions that promoted the thought that white people are the people of comfort and authority, that we are the people of intelligence and beauty, that we are the ones who should be central in social life. These things were woven into the upbringing of every child, consciously and unconsciously. And the various institutions of society explicitly advertised this set of facts, these beliefs. I don't think when you begin to look at it, it comes as a surprise. I think the Times-Picayune, right up until 1970, was one of the great advocates of segregation and white superiority. It's part of the warp and weft of our national life. It's not a regional phenomenon.
Slaves and the Family receive some criticism for your appearance in the story. And in this book, In Life of a Klansman, your thoughts and reactions to the life of Polycarp Constant Licourne are such an important part of this book. There are very powerful moments when you realize that you have to own these feelings, that you say that guilt is something like a stage of grief, and you realize that you have benefited from your ancestors' action. So did you have any reservations about being so open about this? I mean, in a way, as a reader, I think you model the behavior that a non-African-American reader might have reading this book. You know, I'm not sure how someone else might feel. So I'm very curious about the decisions you made about how far to go with those self-revelations.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a matter of law, I do not feel responsible for the crimes that Constant Licourne committed, for the reason that the living cannot control the actions of their predecessors. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of conscience, I do feel implicated in and associated with the racial violence that is a part of my family history. And I think that what I'm trying to do is to take ownership of this narrative instead of deflecting attention from it. A common feeling that we whites have about acts of persecution directed at black people is, oh, it's not, it doesn't involve me. My family were never slave owners. This is, you know, not part of my experience. In fact, we suffered too. Our family suffered too. We were persecuted and we had such a hard time. Whereas I think that right now, in fact, we are experiencing moments of reckoning among millions of white people right now, this summer, when the movement in the aftermath of the killing of George Floyd. And I think that what I want to do in this book is to take ownership of the story of white supremacy and model that as an act of coming to terms.
Now, you said we were shunned by your family when that first book appeared, Slaves in the Family. So how have they reacted to this one?
My first book, Slaves in the Family, tells the story of my father's family in South Carolina, who were major slaveholders for 170 years and enslaved close to 4,000 people. And when I wrote that book, which tells the stories of 10 African-American families whom we once enslaved, I did experience, you know, some sort of ostracism in my father's family in Charleston. Now, this book, Life of a Klansman, tells the story of my mother's family in New Orleans, and my mother's family were not, as we've already said, were not of the elite class and remain somewhat less entitled people. You know, the poet Czesław Miłosz said that when a writer is born, his family or her family is lost because that family is going to be condemned to exposure, embarrassment, and disclosures of all kinds. So in my mother's family, it depends on whom you ask. I don't think anyone in our family really wanted a story of our Klansmen to be a piece of public discussion, but no one tried to stop me from telling it. The common thing is that people say is, oh, he was a bad seed. He's not in my branch of the family, or oh, I didn't know about this guy. The common thought is that our Klansman is not like us. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, phenomenon of disavowal that we were talking about a moment ago, the idea of disavowal is that you know something is true and yet you wish that it were not true. So I have not had a hard time with my mother's family. I'm quite close with many of them.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Edward Ball, whose new book is Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Now, you dedicate this book to your children, Abigail and Theodore. How old are they, and how do you talk to them about family history?
They're teenagers in high school and middle school.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that Daddy has written about slave owning in the family, and now he's written about Klansmen in the family, and they are aware, and I'm trying to make them aware, that these are stories that are not sugared family histories of the kind that people like to tell, that they are relevant to the current situation and current politics, that our family history has a lot of pain in it, and it's a complicated and evolving thing because they are rather young, but my older child is starting to read some of my writing about our family history, and they do projects in school that have to do with it, and I'm trying to teach them to take ownership of the bad along with the good.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm up to.
Now, as you said, you spent part of your growing up years in New Orleans. Your mother brought you back here after your father died. So what was it like to come back here to write this story? You wrote parts of this book at a studio in the woods, which is such an important place for writers here. What was that experience of walking the streets that your ancestors walked and that you yourself walked as a young man?
It was a lot of pleasure mixed with a lot of ambivalence. You know, anyone who does family history has this experience, to walk in the steps of your predecessors. It's electrifying, and it's self-defining. If you find a story and where it transpired, and you visit that place, and it's marvelous, and I recommend it. The truth of the archival history of the LeCorns and of the majority of Americans, for that matter, is that they were people invisible to history with a capital H, and to reconstruct their lives was a matter of sifting thousands of pages of public records with the help. I had a very good helper, a man named John Bardis, who was a wonderful researcher who excavated quite a lot of documents for me. So it was a combination to re-enter New Orleans, was a combination of the sort of dreamlike experience of returning to the scene of youth, my youth and family, which and also quite a lot of sort of painstaking research, putting together tiny bits of evidence into a mosaic of a story, of a family history.
It's such an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, when you're here and you're writing, it's almost as if you get this overlay of the contemporary city over the past. It's almost like the past city shimmers for you underneath it all. And you see it as you walk. a lot of the streets in my neighborhood were in this book. And so,
is that right?
So I drove around a lot.
That's funny.
And thought about it. Yeah. So it was really meaningful in that way. It's like, here, you know.
Train your mind to peel back the layers of time as you walk into a city. If you can see in your mind's eye what was there a century and a half before you were born. And that's the kind of transport, the kind of traveling that historians allow you to do. And as I said, I recommend it.
Well, you do it so well. This is an eye-opening, kind of chastening book. So we've been talking with Edward Ball, whose new book is Life of a Klansman, A Family History in White Supremacy. Edward Ball, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org.